Dr. Quinn Gentry, and Dr. Gentry is president and CEO of Messages of Empowerment Productions, an evaluation research firm. She has also recently completed a postdoc fellowship in public health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and she's a doctor of sociology. And so she's going to be talking about the social construction of motherhood among women with mental illness and co-occurring disorders. Dr. Gentry.
Okay, so I guess I need to put my first disclaimer out. If you're looking for a big N, this is not the presentation. I have nothing else to disclose except we don't have a big sample size. The purpose of this study was to examine motherhood as a gender-specific social phenomenon among women with mental health and substance abuse co-occurring disorders. And I looked at the data for the express purpose of coming up with some practical solutions as to how can we get systems to be more gender responsive in terms of mental health interventions. So this has a lot packed into it. I have placed the public health imperative and the research methods on the same slide, but one of the things that I, in coming out of sociology and into public health, I noticed that everyone is talking about the social determinants of health, but very few people are actually developing interventions and approaches to address those social determinants. Seems like all of the interventions still go back to an individualistic framework. So one of the things that I hope to be able to do is to make some contributions to how can we start to think about how do you change the systems to be more responsive to those social determinants that we're so good at unpacking and deconstructing. And for me, one of those social determinants is gender. So with that, I was part of a project where they had already done some formative research for a depression intervention, and I was able to obtain the data sets to look at. I was actually just looking at women, and so I sort of discovered this whole mothering code, if you will. Anyone familiar with Atlas TI, someone else can code the data, they can make it valid and reliable, but I came in and looked at it as a secondary data set, and I just pulled the codes on motherhood and mothering. So it was not just looking at the ways in which they mothered, but I also was able to get a little bit of a glimpse on their perspectives on how they were mothered. So I hope to tell this in terms of the social construction of reality. It's very much a part of not just their current state of mothering, but understanding how they were mothered. So in the end, after constantly comparing the diverse ways of mothering and the way in which they were mothered, I noticed that there were two things that emerged. One is a coping mechanism called distant mothers, and another one called difficulties in mothering, and I will explain that as we go along. So in grounded theory, we come at it just a little bit differently. We do all of the grounded analysis and read the case studies, and then we go back and see how the literature actually approaches the issue. So I've pulled the literature, but what I have not had a chance to do is sort of put all the references in, but these are the major themes. When I'm looking at how public health studies marginalize mothers, I notice that that there's a lot on mothers who use crack, heroin, mothers with severe and mild mental illnesses, and there's a ton on mothers with chronic and terminal medical illness, HIV and cancer, had the lion's share of those kinds of articles, and then there's a lot coming out of criminal justice on motherhood. But what I realized is that when I started to lay all of the articles out, there seemed to be this polarized framing of either they concluded that mothers were selfish and unfit, or that they were really resilient and able to cope. So I wanted to find out, you know, well, whether this set of mothers fit within that framing, within that continuum of framework, conceptual framework. So as a sociologist, I looked at the, I come from this from the theoretical frameworks that I am most familiar with and that I hope to use as social determinants of health to help people to interpret and apply some of the social determinants of health that we unravel in public health. So the first one that I looked at was Black feminist theory as an interpretive lens, and I took Hill Collins' work
which is traditional sociology, and I unpacked it for those themes that might be relevant in public health. So I looked at, well, how do these mothers self-define and give value to motherhood? And how is race, class, and gender as intersecting oppressions very much a part of their motherhood experiences? And then what are the unique experiences? Even though there were 11 mothers, there were some things that were very unique and that none of the other mothers experienced. And what were those things that still need to be addressed from an individualistic standpoint? And then what are those controlling images about who is fit to mother and who is not fit to mother in America? And then finally, Hill Collins suggests that no matter what you're doing in your work, you ought to look at just as much the changes that need to happen on a structural level as those changes that need to happen on an agency level. So for that work, in terms of looking at structure and agency, that's where I started to make some initial implications of what do we do with these data. And in public health, you always say, not a lot, because you don't have a big N. But that never stopped the sociologist. And then I looked at symbolic interactionism, just the meaning of motherhood. What are the symbols? What are they doing or saying? Or what's the process? And how are they interacting with their children? And then what is their interpretation of their own mothering experiences? And then finally, the social construction of reality. I wanted to look at their reality of motherhood in terms of the way they were socialized, and also their subjective realities of motherhood in terms of how they personalized motherhood. So we'll see. So in that, I used a constant comparison inquiry to constantly compare those 11 case studies. And so these are the four research areas or research questions that guided my inquiry. And that is, how did mothers make sense of their co-occurring disorder? So first I needed to understand that they actually know that they were recruited into this study because they had co-occurring, and what language did they use that would allow me to believe that they understood that they had this this issue. And then under what conditions are women with co-occurring disorders mothering? And what tactics and strategies are they using to fulfill the mothering role? And finally, what are the implications for new intervention development to effectively address mothers coping with co-occurring disorders? So for that, for the first research question, I focused on how mothers made sense of mental illness. And 9 out of the 11 mothers discussed being depressed and also using illegal and non-prescription drugs, so they understood that they had co-occurring disorders. The biggest stresses that they talked about were children and intimate partner relationships. So I have a second paper that's called It's Complicated, and talking about intimate partner relationships. But for this paper, I obviously focused on child mothering. So these are just select representations to let me know, looking at the narratives as well as charting some of the things, the chronological things or events that have happened, that let me know that that they understand that they have a mental illness, but they also have a substance use problem. And then even one is talking about even her own interaction with her own mother. She says, my mama says to me, you need to see a psychiatrist and get on medication, but I just procrastinate so much. It helps, but you got to find the right one. But for me, I always resorted to drugs, which isn't a good way, but that's what I do. So she understood it. What I thought was good about this is that she had a source of support telling her that she needed to get some psychiatric help. And in other communities, we know that we don't actually have a lot of support saying this is the way to move. There's a lot of stigma and shame around seeking psychiatric help. So the second inquiry was around mother's account of motherhood. And when I read this first quote, I thought, really, I'm reading this, and how in the world could she think that she is like other mothers? So I had to take my own and unpack my own biases and judgments and say, well, let me just really understand what they mean by motherhood. Lots of mothers going through the same thing I'm going through, the same thing or maybe worse. And you would have to know what she meant by what she's going through, by, like, not having custody of her children and living with adult children. And I'm like, that is not normal. But if that is the community that you live in, and if that's what everybody is going through, then that becomes your normal. That becomes your social construction of reality. So here are the key findings of the different dimensions of motherhood. I started to, you know, in statistical analysis, we just look at those demographics, the number of children, but I wanted to look at some other dimensions of motherhood that would give a glimpse of the social construction of reality as these mothers face. So there were only 11 mothers in the study, but here's where we get into some the beginnings of perhaps the epidemiological problem that is lurking in the background. 11 mothers had 41 children. The average number was 3.7, and then there was one mother who had 9 children. So 6 of the mothers were teen mothers. 4 moms had a combination of very, very young children. They seemed to have taken a break from motherhood, and now they had they had some older children, took a break, and then they have this another set of children, which are primarily being raised by their older siblings. Household arrangements and custody. Of the 6 mothers that had minor children, only one had custody of the child, with the others being in kinship care. And 8 mothers had adult children, and 4 mothers actually lived with one or more of their adult children. I even dug into that deeper, whereas 2 of the mothers were the heads of the household, but the other 2 had actually moved back in with adult children to be cared for by the adult children. And then there were different degrees of contact. 5 mothers reported limited to no contact with their children. 5 reported some contact with at least one child, and only one mother out of 11 said that she had constant contact with her children, and defined it as such. And then we're talking about grandchildren in the mix. So we're talking about 5 grandchildren. So you see, you got generational issues packed into this study. The unique experiences of mothers that could negatively impact their co-occurring disorders. One mother had 2 sons in jail, and she saw that as very stressful, and I'll talk about some of that later. 2 mothers had experienced the death of children, and one mother was raped by her biological father, so she said, so my son is also my brother. So talk about social determinants or criminal determinants. But 3 of the mothers, 3 have daughters who are teen moms, and 3 mothers self-reported really, really bad episodes of postpartum depression, which goes into the work that you were all talking about. So the third inquiry was strategies and tactics. What are the strategies and tactics that these mothers are using to mother? And the first theme was around those mothers who had limited or no contact with their minor or adult children. This theme of distant mothering sort of started to emerge. Again, these are the parents of the mothers who do not have constant contact nor custody of their children. But even more than that, what they saw as the lack or limited mothering opportunities, they were constantly depressed. And then there were some sub things. These mothers were always trying to make an effort to mother on the margins, like sending birthday presents or birthday cards when they could, and trying to see their kids at holidays when the relatives would sort of soften and allow them to come by the house and things of that nature. Defending their efforts, including decisions like they sort of flipped the script and made it their choice, and they didn't talk about the kids being removed, but one of the ways in which they cope with distant mothering is this was the best thing for the child to be removed from my care. Blaming the children or other caregivers for her inability to mother effectively, and symbolic worrying about children and their well-being, but still not taking actions to be more than a distant mother. And then the second group of mothers were those who have some contact with the children, and then that one mother that had custody of her child. And what they talked about were difficulties in mothering. So unlike the first group that constantly talked about being depressed, this group constantly talked about being stressed out and children as a huge stressor. And they tended to actually, many of them flipped the script on the parent-child relationship. You would hear them referring to a 14-year-old as grown, you know, so that they could sort of become okay with not having to do a lot of the mothering. You would see them taking on the child role and the child taking on the parent role. Missing nurturing and discipline skills emerged from their narratives, and defending children from dysfunctional significant others. So this is how the work that I plan to do in intimate partner relationships sort of actually spills over into a whole family issue of them being with significant others, whether it's the biological father or some other person that lives in the household that is constantly badgering the children, the adult children, teenagers, and even that one small child. And keeping in touch with problem children or children who are experiencing problems. So they saw that it was difficult, but they were trying to do the best that they could. So these are just some examples of distant mothering, explaining the distance, explaining why there's distance and using that as a reason to be okay with why the child is not in her custody. Symbolic worrying, but still explaining that I'm worried, but they have to stay where they are right now because I'm not in a good space. And then examples of difficulties in mothering. So this mother, she says, I woke up, me and my son had a little argument, but then I got really angry and I told him, and she said the word in school. Now this is stemming from just a little argument, so see the perception. And she says, I'm going to knock your effing head off. I would never hit him, though, she says. I never hit him. I never hit my kid. It should be kid, not kind. I just had a really bad day that day. And then another woman said, my youngest daughter is 17, and she's already on drugs real bad. She stole from me and her sister. And so she was saying I had to put her out, and now she can only come and visit me in the lobby of the apartment complex. Then others are struggling to stay connected with adult children. This woman says, I got a 22-year-old. I go see her every day to make sure she's all right. She don't call me. I guess I have to let the kids go. I got to let them live their own life. So she's going to check on this kid, this 22-year-old, who works in a kitchen. And I sort of detected that she probably gets tips every day, and she's probably trying to go by. That's what I kind of picked up, because the daughter doesn't want to have anything to do with her. But she's struggling to stay connected. And then they, in terms of difficulties in mothering, giving advice and counseling. So this one mother is trying to make her son be happy in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs with just having food, clothing, and shelter. She says, I keep sitting him down and telling my son, don't take life for granted. Life's too short. I'm telling him how lucky he is even to just have something to eat. And again, we'll unravel some of why she feels like just having your basic needs met is just enough when I go to the next level of analysis. And then this other woman talked about the fact that she constantly has to stay in touch with her oldest daughter because she's around a very, very abusive boyfriend. And then defending the children, this is the one I mentioned, the guy that I'm with, he gets drunk and he'll look at my little boy and he'll say, you ain't going to amount to nothing. And I'll interfere in it and I'll tell him, don't sit there and say that. And don't sit there and say that to that child. I have to protect my son. So, and then flipping the script, I mentioned this already, adult children monitoring the mother's behavior and becoming close friends with children and using them as confidants. And this was mostly, when I looked at gender, the two mothers who did this a lot, they did this with sons. I didn't see any women who had really, really close relationships with their daughters. So you see some of the issues. So I wanted to dig a little deeper where if you walk away right there and look at distant mothering and difficulties in mothering, we would stop here and we would put the women in this study on the side of being unfit, right, from that bigger framework. But I said, well, wait a minute, before we do that, let's look at insights into why these mothers are distant and why do they have difficulties fulfilling the mothering role. And when I started to look at the childhood experiences that they discussed in the study, what I realized is that 9 of the 11 women had been mothered under very difficult conditions with extreme histories of trauma, tragedy, abuse, neglect, and abandonment. And just to give you a representative narrative, I put some here, and in the interest of time, I would like to read, where's the one about? Oh, I feel neglect because I was in a foster home and they really treated us like we were dogs. We had to steal the food to get something to eat. So you see why this is a mom who can tell her son, you're lucky just to have something to eat. She would beat us with the board. She shoved the banana peel down my brother's throat. My father always beat my mother. And I asked her why, the question was asked, why were you in foster home in the first place? And this is the reason why. My father always beat my mother because my mother was a drunk and they came and took us to the foster home. So locating mothers with co-occurring disorders within the discourse of marginalized mothers. So this is sort of the social construction of reality that is emerging from the work that I'm doing. Depending upon which systems of care a mother with co-occurring disorders is associated with, her mothering experiences may be framed very differently. So if she's getting counseling, medication, and treatment, she is unable to mother, which sort of gives her a little bit of a victim's identity. But at the same time, if she's unengaged as a mother, and if family members are coming and taking the children without the kids getting into foster care, then, well, I should say government-sponsored foster care as opposed to family kinship, then she's just emotionally unavailable at the moment. So, but if there is a criminal case, if there is substance, neglect, abuse, what are those other ones? Physical abuse, sexual abuse, then she is labeled as unfit to mother if she enters the criminal justice system. And then unwilling to mother is sort of this individualistic, selfish perspective on I just don't want to be a mother. And then unknowing of how to mother is very much a part of this work in light of the ways in which they were mothered. Their own mothers abandoned them. There was death. They were raised by other family members and taken into state custody. So how can you reasonably expect for them to be socialized in a way that would have them to be a normal mother, if you will, within the social construct of an American mother? And so these are just some of the emerging implications. Again, not having a large N does not stop me from looking at implications for programs and intervention development. In line with some of the work that you all talked about, there's room here to look at ways to be gender responsive in existing programs, just being more intentional about talking about postpartum depression, grief and loss, and post-traumatic stress disorders that seem to impact women in different ways than their male counterparts. There's also a continued need for researchers and practitioners to view motherhood within a broader context to fully understand and address unmet needs of mothers with co-occurring disorders. And when I say the broader context, I mean moving from individual issues to social determinants. And further than that, seeing the problems and the solutions as impacting more than just the life of that individual mother. But in this study alone, we had 41 children and 5 mothers had 12 grandchildren. So that's about 53 impacted lives, and the grandchildren will go on to have children as well. So, and then it doesn't also, I have some implications for national funding agencies. So I researched these 8 agencies have some kind of gender responsiveness or gender specificity within the work that they do. But my framing is that if women are facing any or all of these issues in this sort of conceptual framework that is overlapping and complex, then these 8 agencies ought to get together at the top and provide policy and funding and integrated service guidelines to help those in the communities to be able to better be able to say that no, there's no wrong door to enter, no matter what your initial issue is that brings you into service. But we ought to have a network and an integrated approach to services, i.e. the wraparound services, where you can get some help for all of these things that are unpack all of these things that are a part of your issues with co-occurring disorders. And then finally, implications for programs and interventions. One of the things when I look at public health, they ask you to pick one box. Either you're going to do an individual level component, or you're going to do a group level, or you're going to do a community level. And if you listen to the issues that were raised in just these 11 women alone, what they're saying is, can we have multiple interventions, that is, first, can you start at the community level and do something that is consciousness raising or awareness raising, so that when we talk about this issue in public, we're not stigmatized and we're not ashamed of what we're dealing with. And then small group. So this base study was all about a formative research project for a depression group. And the findings from this study says that you need to pull the mothers out and give them yet another subgroup. Because there were men in the study as well. They were going to do a depression group, a mixed gender and race depression group. But this says that you need to get those small groups of folks with shared experiences. And then finally, as you saw, some of the unique experiences that are probably not appropriate for group level discussion, there is still a need for one-on-one sessions. But I believe that it would be all of these interventions working simultaneously that will ultimately get the women where they need to be. So this is my contact information if anyone is interested in continuing dialogue.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions?
I've worked in this area for the last 20-something years.
Wow.
It's a very interesting and descriptive way to look at the stories and to put that together under constructs. I think the field is moving in that direction. Traditionally, mental health and substance abuse have been in silos and worked, you know, within their kind of construct of treating. And now we're developing programs that are more integrated. I'm working with a group through the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is called TSTSA, Trauma Assistance Therapy for Adolescents with Substance Abuse. And so what they are realizing is many of the adolescents who have early substance abuse histories have
these mothers.
Trauma, neglect, substance abuse, sexual abuse. And if we just say no to drugs, that's not enough, then we have to deal with the PTSD and other strategies for coping. So it's kind of an integration of the trauma-informed mental health as well as the substance abuse. And then even the funding streams were very separate, and now we have the mental health parity, substance abuse mental health parity, how that's going to be actualized by the private payers. But I think we are trying to look at these issues. I don't know what I might have missed where you got the data from, but there's a program in Baltimore, Bay Springs, that's right down the street from Hopkins, that provides residential care for women in early recovery, and they have mental health substance abuse on site, Head Start on site.
None of these women were in treatment. They were in the community in high-risk neighborhoods, but not in treatment.
So this program takes women, and there is an 18 two- and three-bedroom unit apartment where they are housed together. As I said, they have Head Start, substance abuse, mental health services on site, and then 66 homes in the community for the latter part, so they stay for 12 to 18 months in the apartment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you see the healing that can take place, it is a shame not try to address the concerns, because as you pointed out, it's just not those 11, it's the 44
and the 12
multi-generation.
Yeah. Any questions for any of the panel members?
What's the average age of the mothers?
The average age was 45, so because they had, but they range from 26 to 61, I think.
These are not teenagers.
Mm-mm.
But some have been.
That's
some
right.
Some of their children are, too. And so
no, some of these were teen moms.
And they have been, but generally speaking, by the time we come to attention and intervention, these are older.
Right, with a lot of complex issues that have been piling up. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for bringing a sociology to this. Large database analysis is very useful to kind of maybe point us in the direction of what to look at and to answer the question of what you do once you've identified a population. You need to know what the stories are in a structured way so that you can figure out what kind of interventions make sense. And for these populations in the public mental health system, they bear on needing a community, a program, and individual intervention. So we need more of these stories. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also, I don't think you need to apologize here.
From a small end.
Yeah, I think programmative theory and criminology studies are quite common, and the aim is really for theoretical generalizability and transferability. So I guess my question is, how would you transfer some of the concepts that are emerged here into other maternal contexts? Because these ideas of distant mothering or typical difficulties of mothering they be transferred to other like conceptual or scholarly areas?
Into other areas of motherhood?
I think these concepts are useful, and I'm just wondering where you see the application of these concepts, you know, outside of the realm of this.
So,
or how can these concepts be?
So if you, as she mentioned, I did a postdoc at Hopkins, but I actually own a firm. I'm a practitioner, so I go from theory to practice. So
okay.
That's why, even though I have So I really want to work with the community to do more gender responsive strategies to develop new interventions that build upon some of these findings. But I know through that work, I'll always need to be connected to research entities to continue to do the data collection or the evidence, or gather the evidence that the things that we propose to do in terms of new intervention development are working. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I was curious whether.
So you're asking what are my ideas about how to translate that into practice?
Mm-hmm.
To turn them into case studies, to use them for trainable moments with those with field recruiters and people who work in at the front lines and things of that nature. Use it as a training technical tool.
That's an important question. I guess mine is more how could these concepts be used more at the theoretical level? Like, could distant mothering could that apply to maybe women who are in prison? Like other populations, could it be used as an interpretive lens?
And so now I see why I missed your question,
okay,
because that's exactly where I am now. If you remember, I said in the beginning that I've waited and first examined the case studies, and now I'm looking at the literature. So of course, now that I know what my concepts look like, I'll reread the articles that I pulled, right, and to see how they fit within the literature and get it hopefully published in that way. Absolutely, in the criminal justice system, but also in drug court programs, in child welfare, where I think at a broader level, those systems need to talk to each other in terms of the drug. Renette can explain this better, but it's the child welfare system says that this child will be placed in permanent homes within or adopted within 12 months, and the treatment systems say they need at least 18 months to 24 months. So those systems are not talking to each other. So if they could understand the importance or the significance of distant mothering and difficult mothering, and that these mothers are trying and they're doing things, and perhaps if they come into treatment, you need to give some kind of policies or to allow for this to be a case that is not treated in the normal way that, I guess, either law, so they're very complicated.
And to help support the parents who are going through the process of receiving those services so they can eventually be reunified with their family.
Yeah. Because, like I said, I'm thinking about there were six mothers who had minor children and only one had custody.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Any other questions? And if our presenter is available for more questions, if people want to talk to them individually. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Just, someone was asking too about what to do. There were two that I looked up. I think they may be presentations and posters. One of them's a poster. But this is in Oregon. I think it was this session on improving mental health services with Dr. Sharma, and I can't get an internet connection to figure out what session it is. But it's she's speaking from 4:50 to 5:10, so it's got to be in one of the 4:30 sessions on an integrative program in the Bronx to address maternal mental health and child welfare postpartum. It looked like a really, really good session.
Well, thank you, all of you, very, very much. Lots to think about. Thank you all.